being a small business, trying to cash flow everything and whatnot, the challenges that you face as a craft distiller, and how many people told you do not do it?
Oh, at the beginning?
Yes.
Yeah, mainly my wife and my parents. So.
This is Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon, bringing to you the best in news, reviews, and interviews with people making the bourbon whiskey industry happen. And I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Coleman. Now, it's no secret that we're huge fans of Finger Lakes Distilling, since it is one of the most crucial components in the blend of Pursuit United. And a few months ago, we booked some flights and took our recording equipment on the road to go to upstate New York. And we sat down with their president, owner, and former distiller, Brian McKenzie. We talk about his journey into whiskey and some of the challenges he faced as a craft distiller just getting started. We cover the unique aspects of being a craft distiller with a column still, which is actually very rare to see. Their incredibly low barrel entry proof, which is usually around 100, and their infamous weeded bourbon. With that, enjoy this week's episode, and now here's Fred Minnick with Above the Char.
I'm Fred Minnick, and this is Above the Char. This week's idea comes from Jaden Mullins. And the question's so good, I don't have an answer for it, but it's a philosophical question of our time. Just wanted your opinion since I can't find any information myself. My question is, considering the reason bourbon is amber is essentially due to the oak barrel leaching into the whiskey.
That's true.
All that color comes from the barrel. How much bourbon would one have to drink to consume a barrel's worth of wood? All right, Jaden, how many woodchucks would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck chucked some wood? I mean, I think we have the new philosophical question of our lifetime here, folks. Jaden Mullins just changed the game. How many barrels have you consumed? I mean, if you think about it, Kenny, Ryan, and I, we may as well be an oak forest between the three of us with how much bourbon we've consumed in our lifetime. If you want to think about it from that perspective, I mean, we're just a walking white oak forest in my belly. I got trees growing in there. Yeah. I mean, to be honest with you, Jaden, I have no idea. I just love the question. I think it's funny. I don't think it's funny, but I think it's worth pondering. And I'm going to run it up the flagpole to someone, you know, who can bring us a real answer here. I'm going to go to Independence Dave with this question, and I'll probably read it later. But I had to get this out in the universe for everyone to hear. I want you to let us know on Twitter or Instagram or wherever, how many barrels do you think you have consumed? How many full barrels of like the actual wood do you think you have consumed in your lifetime? That's going to do it for this week's Above the Char. Hey, if you're like Jaden and you have a cool idea, hit me up on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or write me on fredminnick.com with your question. Hopefully, I won't be stumped. No pun intended. Like I was here with Jaden. But if I like it, I'll read it on the air. Until next week, cheers.
From their bar to yours, Chad and Sarah of the popular YouTube channel It's Bourbon Night bring you their favorite at-home old-fashioned mix with the new Elemental Elixirs Golden Hour Syrup. It's a custom-made syrup with notes of bold black tea, warm spices, and orange zest. All you need is your favorite whiskey and ice. No bitters needed. One bottle makes 16 drinks, so that's only $1 cocktail before you add your own whiskey. They can also be enjoyed in other cocktails or spirits, mocktails, coffee, tea, and anything you can think of. It's crafted locally in Lexington, Kentucky, and you can get your bottle now at whiskeyambitions.com.
It's that time again to get bourbon strong with Give270. Purchase your $50 tickets for your chance to win from our 50 bourbon prizes. Don't miss out on rare bottles and grand prizes like the legendary Pappy Set, a Weller Rainbow, and the Blood Oath Trilogy. Hurry, only 3,000 tickets are available. Single bottle winners go back in for the grand prize draw. Will you win the ultimate Pappy Set or one of our other incredible prizes? Get your tickets now at Give270.org. Charitable gaming license ORG 0002703.
It's that time of the year where everybody's starting to make their vacation plans on visiting Kentucky, the mecca of bourbon. And if you are coming to Kentucky, you need to make sure you visit us at Pursuit Spirits in Louisville, We're right in the heart of Clifton, near Butchertown and Nulu, and only just a few miles away from downtown Louisville. But when you do come, you need to book your experience to go do our whole shebang. This is the one that's really the star of the show. You get a full-on tasting. You get to do your own personal barrel selection experience. And you get to grab a whiskey thief and fill your bottle directly from the barrel. We're doing something completely brand new that nobody else is doing here in Bourbon Country. Plus, you get a free sweet tasting glass at the end of it. I guarantee you, you're going to end up being one of the many people that's also leaving us a 5-star review. So make sure you come and check us out. You can book your reservation by going to pursuitspirits.com and clicking the Visit Us button. Welcome, everybody, back to another episode of Bourbon Pursuit, the official podcast of bourbon. Kenny and Ryan going on the road. I think this is the furthest north we've ever been to record, but it's exciting.
I think so. The furthest north we were was yesterday, and now we've extended it.
Another one. So we are up in the Finger Lakes region of New York, which is a beautiful area.
Yeah.
And I actually got to experience something new today, too. When we were driving, we rented a VW Passat, and I got to see what the cruise control, when it senses a car in front of you, is adaptive cruise control. I've realized what I've been missing out on this entire time with having something.
Kenny's just going back and forth, and he's like, see this, it'll test the line, and autograph's like, just like, grab the damn
my
wheel.
My hands are off the wheel. I'm like letting it like go ahead and move itself. And
yeah, I wasn't a fan, but he was.
I was like,
me riding and partying last night, so I'm a little anxious already. So I was like, just grab the damn wheel. But we flew into Rochester. I think it's about an hour and a half down here to the distillery, and it reminds me a lot of Kentucky, a lot of beautiful rolling fields, cornfields, wheat fields, soy, and then you get up and you're on this massive, massive body of water. You know, just
huge,
on one of the fingers. I don't know how many fingers there are.
Five.
Okay. But the one I saw, is the one we're on, is pretty big. And I think Brian said it was like 630 feet deep. That's some bodies will stay down there fresh down there.
Some bodies, you get some scuba training in, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But this trip's been long overdue. I mean, gosh, we've been buying whiskey from Brian for 3 or 4 years now. He's been a critical partner with our Pursuit series, and then he's a critical component of the United Blend. And so we were happy to finally make it up here, because we've been sending him checks. We need to just make sure there's some barrels up here for us.
It's a running joke. Yeah, the checks are cashing. Let's make sure we have the barrels up here.
He's been such a pleasure to work with, and they have such fantastic whiskey, and we're so happy to have a long-term partnership and glad to see it all in the flesh now. It's awesome.
Yeah, definitely. So we've talked about him. Let's go ahead and introduce him and have him on here. So today on the show, we have Brian McKenzie. He is the founder and president of Finger Lakes Distilling. So Brian, welcome back to the show.
No, this is awesome to have you guys here in person. Gotten to know you a bit over the years, and now it's just great to show you the place. And as you see, we do have some barrels here for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're like, came up here, I don't have to go there or get on a Zoom call. You know, it's easy for you.
So the last episode you were on was episode 169. So it's been a bit.
I thought it was 168, but
he's keeping count. What's changed since then?
Well, I think we talked mainly about our Empire Rye project back then, but you know, that's still something we're really involved with. But honestly, just continued growth for us, and you know, just trying to do things the right way and scale up the business and continue to sock whiskey aside and, you know, host people. Obviously, we went through a pandemic, so that's a big change, but I feel like we're stronger than ever.
How is the pandemic for you guys here? You know, you're a big tourist town. You know, you got a lot of visitors. Come enjoy the lake. How did that affect you all last year?
Yeah, we felt the pain just like everybody, I guess, at the beginning. You know, New York State was pretty aggressive in the early stages, so we shut down for a few months. We didn't shut down production at all. We were still continued to be deemed essential. I think people needed their whiskey more than ever at that time. So we switched gears and did some hand sanitizer for the local hospitals, but never really committed to, you know, tanker trucks of ethanol and stuff like that. But we knew there was a need, so we did some of that. And then once we got open in June, the Finger Lakes were really just an ideal place for people to get out of the cities. You know, come up, hike, be outside. We had a beautiful summer. And then we kind of did a lot of business outside on our property so people could have a cocktail, be socially distant, and, you know, just have some fun again. So we had a good season and generally not that bad of a year. And now I think there's this just built up excitement to get out and have fun. And we're seeing that with increased traffic this year.
kick a few back. Yeah. So wait, and this isn't actually a really good region to be able to do it. And I kind of want to talk about, because this is our first time visiting the area. And if you've never been up here, Ryan and I were driving and wineries, like they're everywhere. Looks like you've got the market cornered a little bit on the distilling on the side over here, which is great. I think I saw a few breweries,
but not many distillers.
But, you know, I kind of want to talk about you in your background a little bit too. Did you grow up in this area and decide like, this is what I want to do. I want to open up a business. I want to do distilling. Kind of talk about your journey into finding whiskey and then wanting to kind of build this business.
Yeah. So I think it goes back to even before I was around. My grandfather came here from Scotland, and I think there's a lot of similarities with this area with the rolling hills and the lakes and everything. So it kind of has that feel a little bit to it. We're really well known for our wines in the area. We have hundreds of wineries making things like Riesling, Alsatian varietals, and really becoming kind of world renowned for that. I'm from here. I grew up a little south of here, went to school in Ithaca, and have lived here most of my life. I was not somebody that grew up in distilling. I actually, my background's in banking and finance. And
spreadsheets get boring, huh?
Yeah. They did, yeah. So did wearing a tie and, that kind of thing. But
yeah, you don't seem like a shirt and tie kind of guy.
I was for a long time.
Yeah, wow.
But it's just something that had always interested me, heading over to Scotland and seeing the distilleries, spending time, where you guys are from down in Kentucky. It just, every place we traveled, it was something I wanted to do is see, the local distillery or, how the products were made, and just became an interest. And as I had a transition with the banking career, I knew I wanted to start a business, wanted to start something that kind of dovetailed well with the local wine industry, and kind of brought those three things together with my interest in spirits, and just thought it'd be a really fascinating business opportunity here in the Finger Lakes.
So I guess talk about the whiskey journey for you. I mean, were you fascinated with whiskey? Did you start collecting it? Like how did you become enthralled with it to the point you said, I'm going to start buying some grains and getting a still and put this together?
I think it started in Scotland. Like I said, I sat down with a bartender. I can't remember what town I was in. And, I wasn't too old. I was, maybe a few years into my drinking career. And he just kind of took me through the different regions of Scotland and just to think that all of those products were made with the same base ingredient, but they tasted so differently, was really interesting to me. And I wanted to know what made, the Islay heavy peat scotch different from, something in the Highlands and that kind of thing. So he educated me a bit, and it kind of sparked the interest and just went from there. So.
And then coming back into the American whiskey side and wanting to start a distillery, were you looking at like, oh, we need to find somebody to help guide us through this? Like, we don't know what we're doing the first thing. Calling Vendome, like, what do we do? Like, what were those first phone calls?
Yeah, I think some of it was a little research and development on my own. You're not supposed to be.
Let me guess. You found some copper, you forged your own still, and you started like figuring this out. Is that how the story goes?
Never admit to that. No. But yeah, I mean, you kind of have to get a comfort level with it. And we're lucky we have Cornell University here too. They have a test still, and actually they have a bunch of stills on campus now. So that was a legal way to get out there and run the equipment and just to get kind of used to how it all works. And so we started back in 2008, which was a long time in the world of craft spirits at this point. And there wasn't a lot of education out there. You couldn't take classes too much or it was just a lot of reading, visiting other distilleries, talking to people. The equipment manufacturers are helpful to some degree, but they're there to sell equipment, not to teach you how to run the equipment. So
yeah,
love the guys at Vendome, but yeah, no, it's just been one of those things that you just try to figure out as you go.
So when you said you were fascinated with Scotland and I'm assuming single malts and whatnot, or was that your focus at first? Like, I want to recreate single malts and make my own American malt style, but now you're obviously known with us for bourbon, but what was kind of like the initial game plan for the distillery and what you were going to distill?
Yeah, we started distilling single malt right from the beginning. We've kind of adopted that whole theme, with our building, the architecture of the building. We've got kind of a Scottish inspired design with the pagoda roof and the stucco finish on the building and everything. But I guess my taste has really moved to American whiskeys. We still make the single malts, and we put out our first single malt a year or so ago that was a 10.5-year-old single malt, which we're real proud of, and we've got more in the pipeline there. But most of our production's bourbon and rye at this point.
Okay, so if you're going to doing a lot of stuff in Scotland, peat or no peat, where do you stand on this?
Depends on the situation.
Oh,
I love peat, but
Okay, we're gonna go ahead and put a hard line in the sand. We're gonna be on the no peat aisle over here.
We're like sherry finish, sweet as possible.
Yeah, I mean we're
bourbon guys,
corn guys. Right? It's corn guys. That's what it comes down to. So you were starting to distill single malts, and I think really what put you on the map with us, and I think a lot of people, is your wheated mash bill, and that's kind of really what started perking some ears up. Talk first about, you know, where you got the idea. Said, okay, well, I mean, I guess we can do a wheated bourbon, or was that the first one you tried? Like, kind of talk us through that situation.
No, my personal preference is for rye bourbon. So that's been our emphasis over the years, which may have not been the best strategy now that we've seen how well the wheat has sold. But yeah, we continue to sell a lot of, I call it a high rye bourbon. It's 20% rye in the mash bill. That's got some nice age on it now. The wheated bourbon was really just something, you know, we have a pretty strong single barrel program. So we started laying down some wheated barrels with maybe the idea of selling those through the single barrels. And then we had enough stock at one point where we put out the bottled and bond product with the wheated mash bill and sold through it really fast. So now we're trying to catch up, and hopefully within the next year to year and a half, we'll have pretty good stocks of that going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're always trying to squeeze more wheated bourbon out of him. He's like, guys, I would love to, but I don't even have enough for me to bottle. And you always say like, gosh, if I'd known 4 years ago, 5 years, and we all say that, you know, he's like, I would have put so much more wheated bourbon down. That's this business. You just forecasting is impossible.
It's true.
Talk about that as from a craft distiller's mindset of forecasting and how challenging it all is from, you know, being a small business, trying to cash flow everything and whatnot, the challenges that you face as a craft distiller. And how many people told you, do not do it?
Oh, at the beginning?
Yes.
Yeah, mainly my wife and my parents. So. Yeah. I'm actually, you know, my background is forecasting, and you mentioned spreadsheets, but I kind of threw all that out the window in the early days. You know, it was most of our emphasis in the early days was just, laying down whiskey. We knew, we kind of felt that there would be a market for it. So it was really kind of allowing the cash flow from the business to dictate how much we were going to set aside that year. You know, now that we're a little more mature and been at it for a while, you know, we're looking into the different categories of whiskeys that we make and how much to set aside each year.
Yeah, but you're having fun with it too, because you're doing a lot of different, you know, when you talk about the different types of mash bills and different things, like I look behind you, you've got a buckwheat. I mean, you're kind of experimenting with a lot of things, and usually I'm...
Yeah, we've had a spelted bourbon. We've had some cherry malt rye and all these wild concoctions, and they're all fantastic.
Do you have like a grain supplier? He's like, hey, I got something special for you in the back if you go ahead and pull out your credit card now. Like, how does that's what it actually works?
We, like I said, the single barrel program has driven a lot of that. So we don't want to just offer, you know, an older high rye bourbon as part of that package. I mean, sometimes we do, but we want these one-offs where people get excited that we've, you know, there's only one or two of these barrels, you know, and we have such a really interesting agricultural mix here in the Finger Lakes that it's fun to play around with everything. I wish, you know, you know, it's great that we've got our core products and we'll continue to really push that. But I don't think we'll ever, you know, get away from being a little bit more experimental like that.
Yeah. Fun. I vote for more spelt bourbon. That was a good one.
Yeah. But I mean, it's also tough to look at something like that, because as a founder and a president now, and you're looking of forecasting and trying to make sure that you've got, you know, everything set aside. Usually when I look at it in that aspect, I'm like, well, I know the wheated bourbon's great. It's going to sell. Let's go all in on that. So what's your idea of, is it not just so much of like, okay.
You sound a lot smarter than me right now.
Well, it's just one of those things.
He thinks he is.
It's you know, I think of it like, oh, okay. Like it's a formula that works. Like, let's just go all in here. But I think you have a little bit more of a creative mindset too. And it's not just all analytical. And you think like, well, no, we've got to experiment. We've got to expand our horizons. We've got to try something different.
That's why Kenny needs an idea, man. Not just a exactly. Spreadsheet, man.
That's the role you play.
Exactly. It's like, all right, Kenny, here's my idea. You implement it.
No, it's a good point. I mean, you know, a lot of companies have been very successful just with that mindset that you find a winner and you just run with it. And I think maybe I'm downplaying the fact that, you know, we're really committed to those products and we spend most of our production, you know, making those, but we got into the business to have some fun too. And I think, you know, playing around with some of these other mash bills and even some of the finishes, I know that's gotten really trendy lately and we don't get crazy with all the, you know, different finishes, but that's fun too, you know, just to work with other local craft beverage providers in the area to kind of see what their products can do, you know, intermingling with what we make. So
what's been one of your favorite experiment mash bills and, you know, concoctions or whatnot?
Well, one that I think has become less of a one-off and something that we're going to, you know, make a lot more of going forward is 100% malted rye, New York State malted rye. I love that whiskey. That came out really nice. So that's become, you know, a yearly small production, but something that we're going to do annually now. You know, some, as far as like the finished whiskeys, we did a rye that we finished in a Pommeau barrel, which is, I don't know if you guys have tried that before.
No. Just go basically ahead, like, get geeky on us here.
Basically like sweet apple cider that's been fortified with apple brandy.
Oh, sounds delicious.
Yeah. So it is kind of like an after dinner drink, but they aged that in our rye barrel. We took that back and finished our rye in it. And that was really delicious. So
I had one you did for Blake at Sealbox. It was an ice wine finish. That was really interesting. I crushed that bottle. It went fast. It was very good.
Yeah.
What do you find more fun in, the finishing or the experimentation of the mash bills?
I'd say the experimentation of the mash bills. Mainly because, you know, you're making something and you don't know what that's going to taste like for 4 or 5 years, or maybe more. So I think it just kind of builds more anticipation.
So you've kind of taken, you know, you were starting distilling, but now you're kind of taking more of the president CEO role. Talk about your master distiller, Jared, and what you sought out in him and what kind of he brings mindset does he bring to the table here at Finger Lakes for you?
Yeah. So, you talked about the idea man and then the guy that's executing. He's the guy that executes. He's amazing. he's an analytical chemist. So he's got his PhD in chemistry. Really smart guy, but you know, understands that there's some art behind this as well. So he appreciates that. And probably the best thing about him is he can fix just about anything. And that's what you need in a distiller, because
something
busting up
to go wrong.
Yeah. That's for sure.
Let's just talk about that. I mean, when you're starting this distillery and you are trying to figure out how your still works, and I know that you have two stills now, so you can kind of flip-flop and figure out which one you want, but did you have problems and figuring things out? I know we mentioned before you started that you kind of helped the Vendome made the still, but you actually pieced it together like it was like a Lego set. They kind of just put everything here.
Wish it was that easy.
Yeah. Kind of tend to talk
like
about
like a Kia furniture.
Well, we started with a pot still, kind of a hybrid still that you see in a lot of the craft distillers, because it gives you the versatility to make everything. So we can make our gin and vodka. We started making whiskey on that. But this has been about 8 years ago now. I think we were one of the first craft distillers to put in a continuous still. And worked real closely with Rob at Vendome, you know, because there weren't really small continuous stills in the market. You know, it was a kind of a new venture. About the same time we got ours, I know Jim Beam got theirs, kind of their little test still, about the same size as ours. But yeah, there were some growing pains with that, just trying to figure out, you know, how to regulate steam with it. And there were definitely some growing pains putting that one in, but now it's been fantastic and it makes a wonderful whiskey and perfect size for kind of our setup here.
Why does craft guys, why do they prefer a pot still over a column still? I know because column still is like consistent, predictable, you know. Why do they like all the, I guess maybe it's an art, but I don't know. Why do they like that? And what does Jared prefer?
He definitely prefers the continuous still.
He doesn't get a choice.
You're like, I just bought this damn thing.
I think the craft guys think that the pot still somehow makes a superior whiskey, but I disagree. I think the continuous is the way to go, particularly with American style whiskeys. You know, they're a little bit trickier.
Why so with the American style?
Well, I mean, I guess we run everything on that in terms of rum and brandy and everything. So, you know, it's just our preference is the spirit that comes off of that still. As far as like, you know, more traditional like European style whiskeys, like we make an Irish style, we do run that through the pot still just to kind of keep with that tradition, I guess.
I got you.
And you were mentioned earlier that your pot still is really there for gin, rum, and some clear spirits that you're doing, because you're doing a whole lot of stuff here. I mean, it's just not the whiskey category.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. And with Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. And you can get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/bourbon, all lowercase, and go to shopify.com/bourbon to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/bourbon.
You're doing a whole lot of stuff here. I mean, it's just not the whiskey category.
Yeah, we have 22, I think, of our own SKUs. A lot of them are just for the local market and our tasting room and that kind of thing. But we contract manufacture, you know, another 5 or 6 brands too.
Yeah.
Besides whiskey, what's your favorite baby?
I like gin, particularly this time, you know, in the summertime. And then, I don't know, I drink a lot of rum in the wintertime because it makes me feel like I'm not in, you know, upstate New York where it's 10 degrees out.
Yeah, nice and cold. You can pretend I'm on a beach.
Yep.
Yeah, speaking of gin, you had like a cool thing for visitors here in your tasting room that they can do. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the original gin program, people can come in small groups and they take a half a day with us to get to know the gin botanicals and kind of formulate their own blend using the 25 that we have available to them. And then once they have them that kind of zeroed in, they grind up the botanicals themselves. We charge the still. We have a small still that can make small batches for them, and we run the gin and then bottle it up for them. We get like 40 bottles for the group to take home with them.
That's cool. Can we do that with some whiskeys?
we're trying to figure out how to apply it to
sounds like a huge pain in the ass.
Yeah, it sure does. It sure does. Now, the one thing I want to notice, and I see it all the time, especially from the barrels that we've gotten back from doing Pursuit Series, Pursuit United with you, is your barrels, it's like they're 4 years old, but they look like they're 30. Kind of talk about, we were kind of talking about that beforehand, kind of talk about your
seasoning process.
Yeah, it was like your patented aging process here.
They basically come to us and, you know, we don't have a ton of space here. So we store barrels that haven't been filled outside. And, you know, the weather can change within minutes here in terms of rain and, you know, can get very hot and humid. But we fill these things up pretty quickly, but they will sit outside for a little while and they do weather a little bit before we fill them up and bring them in.
Hey, it's working. The whiskey tastes great.
Yeah, I know. So
don't change it.
It was funny.
Sorry they're not pretty enough for
no,
you.
No, yeah.
He likes bougie barrels.
It's just funny. It's just funny because you see it, like, you know, we get barrels dumped from all kinds of places all the time. And you're most of the time you look at it and you're like, oh, that's got some rusted rings. Like that's probably some good one. Oh, that one's got some bird shit on it. Like we look at yours and you're like, it's like you got like tar covered in it. Like it's just amazing. Like
it's
how
all
the
part
weather's
of the process.
Yeah, it's part of their traditional aging process up here.
It'll be good on the inside. Yeah, that's what counts, right?
It's all that matters in the inside.
Yeah, it's true. It's all that matters in the inside. I guess. And while we're talking about barrels, kind of talk about your, you know, your barrel thought process. I mean, a lot of these are coming from Kelvin. was that just your thought process when you first started, or like you said, like, oh, we'll try a few different cooperages? Where was your head at there?
Yeah, we've worked mainly with McGinnis and Kelvin over the years, and we're real happy with the whiskey that's coming out of the Kelvin barrels right now. So we're using them primarily.
I can't remember, are they at three or four?
Mostly fours. We'll lay down some threes every once in a while, but our standard bourbon and rye come out of fours. I think the thing that sets us apart when it comes to the barrels is the proof, the entry proof. We go in the barrel at 100 proof, which is, you know, usually 100 or 102 if it's something that might be destined for the bottled and bond product, but that's quite low by industry standards. We made a commitment to do that early on, basically by, you know, just kind of getting to know the history of whiskey over the years and even tasting some of the whiskeys that were, you know, made back before they changed the laws and brought the, you know, proof up to 125. So we're just really happy with the way that higher water content in the whiskey kind of works with the oak and acts as a little bit different solvent. And then we don't have to add much cut water at the time of bottling either. So, you know, your product's been aged all together and you're not adding just clear water to it.
Yeah, I mean, a barrel proof whiskey at 105 is an easy drinker.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
Dangerously delicious. So do you think that, you know, that's why like your product at like say 4 years or 5 years so much more enjoyable versus like we've tried stuff from the big distillers at 4 or 5 and we're like, can't even like stomach it, you know, or sometimes it's very green tasting, just, you know, very corn forward. Do you think that that plays a difference?
I think that plays a big part of it. Yeah. Because I think even our whiskeys at, you know, even 2 to 3 years old start to taste pretty good. I mean, we like to extend beyond that. And I think they only get better.
Pretty good off the still. We were trying some earlier that we did. I'm like, holy cow. It's already that fruity goodness of the still, man.
It sure is.
So, no, but I do think the lower entry proof contributes to that. I don't want to say it ages faster, but it does take on a little bit more maturity for that age.
So everybody I give finger licks to, because every time somebody comes over my house, I want to show you. I'm like, because everybody's at Everything Kentucky, and I'm like, I want you to try this. Tell me. And they say it just has like this big, bold, like fruitiness to it that they're not used to with Kentucky bourbons. Where does that come from you all, without giving your secrets away?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think one thing about our distillery that's kind of unique is we're nestled right in, you know, with a bunch of vineyards right around us, including our own. And, you know, when we're even in the winter, you know, those doors are open to the distillery pretty much all day long. We do open top fermentation, you know, with no temperature control. I think we're picking up a lot of, you know, wild yeasts from the vineyards and the other farms locally. So that's going to create much different flavor profiles than if you were in the Midwest or something like that with all the vineyards that we have here.
Does that scare you at all? Wild yeast just kind of like floating around?
Not yet. I mean, it's working.
I mean, you're going to distill it, but I mean, this, at some point, do you get concerned? Because again, remember we talked about it before. I like consistency and I like to kind of know what my project is going to be like.
Yeah. No, I think wild yeasts aren't anything that I'm concerned about. I think that's, if anything, given some nice extra flavor to the whiskey. We're very controlled when we set the fermenter to make sure all the conditions are just right. So you're not, you know, you're not going to have bacteria. That's the stuff that you don't want to have competing with the yeast and can mess up your fermentation. But
have you had any issues ever when you're like, this fermentation is not going to work?
No, like I said, Jared is
coming up the still green. What's going on here?
Jared is a very precise individual, and you know, he kind of keeps things very consistent, like you said there.
So earlier, we were talking about that you might have a double digit product coming out this year.
Oh yeah,
yeah. This will be our first 11-year-old bourbon that'll be released in a few months.
How hard is it to hold on? Because I'm having a hard time, and I've just been in this business for like 2 or 3 years. How hard is it to hold on something for 11 years?
It's tough. We did the same thing with that single malt, and I think the most frustrating part isn't so much the time, but it's when you look at it at the end of that span, and you know you've got half of what you put in there because the angels got their part of it, you know. So that's tough, but that's only making the whiskey better too. So kind of have to deal with it.
Well, I mean, is when you look at it, are you thinking like, oh, maybe 11 years is our sweet spot? or are you like, nah, we're good at like 4, 5, 6? Like, what's your thought process?
We really like the whiskey kind of, it depends on the product. The bourbon, you know, I think like that 5, 6 year range is really a good spot for us. The rye, you know, we'll still mix in some younger whiskey with that. Mainly just because I think, you know, you start to lose some of that spicy character with the whiskey when it starts to compete with the oak too much. So we like the rye a little bit younger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's getting to 11 years. You're right. It's tough to hold on to it, especially I'm sure after 11 years, you keep going back and sampling it.
Yeah.
And you're like, and did you finally get to 11? You're like, all right, now it's ready.
I blamed it on the Angels, but you know, distiller's share too.
Is that the oldest one? Is there any more down the line? That's
the oldest one I've got in stock right now, and we've got a few to follow that up with. So yeah, we may hold one a little bit longer. I worry that our whiskey may kind of hit its peak at that age, to be honest with you. Maybe having to do with that
the low entry proof.
Yeah,
and that's always what I've wondered is like, is that, you know, the big boys, because they're at that higher proof, is it built for age? You know, that 8 to 12 year, you know, kind of mark, whereas the lower entry proof is better at lower proof. So it's like, I'm just trying to understand why people do things. You know, it's like, why does everybody do 4? Why do they do 125? Why do they do 100? You know, just trying to understand everybody's methodology.
So with us being small, you know, our warehouse isn't very big, you know, 5,000 square feet, and the ceilings aren't real high. So it's kind of creating an environment where there isn't a huge discrepancy between what's on the, you know, lower shelves and what's up top.
I like to call it shelves. Yeah.
Shelves.
You don't have a tier 6.
Yeah.
Just Rick pallet 6.
Yeah. We do have some heat in the floor of the warehouse too, just because the winters, you guys picked a great time to come, but
when we were trying to plan, he's like, do not come, just come in the summer. You know, not any other time of the year.
Do not come.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a very long winter here, so we do have to give a little heat.
I think the last winter you were like, you know, I was trying to get a hold of you and hadn't for a while, and you're like, sorry, man, plow hit, you know, fermentation tank or a holding tank or something. What was that happen?
Yeah, I think the plow hit our, you know, our spent grain tank outside, and then it happened to all pour inside of one of our warehouse buildings. So it was fun.
Oh man, gotta love it.
Call ServPro.
love being the owner. Get that call.
Yeah, we are ServPro. You're like, around here.
I guess should be back in banking.
You know, another question about the lower entry proof as well. Does that have a lot of impact in regards of excise tax or anything like that that you are paying on the actual end product when it goes to being dumped or anything like that?
Not really, because the only products that we're not cutting are the cask strength single barrels. So, you know, we pay the tax on what the bottle leaves the warehouse at, the tax paid warehouse at. So, you know, because we do quite a few single barrels, it has some implication. So if we're putting one out at 103 proof versus 120 proof, you know, there'll be some implication there, but not anything substantial.
You got 120 proofer?
No, because we don't go in that high.
And it doesn't get that.
We've seen is like 110, 111, something like that.
Yeah, and it doesn't get that hot here to where it can get up to those 120 range.
That's right.
And whatnot.
That's crazy. Well, who knows? Now that, you know, we'll be putting down some barrels here, we might throw a 120 or 115 or just, who knows? Just see.
Throw a wrench in Jared's day.
Yeah,
those damn pursuit guys. Yeah, fucking everything up.
But hey, we're paying for the experimentation, not them, right?
So right.
It's a lot easier. If it ends up like we're like, we gotta wait till it turns 15, we're like, well, that's why we price it out
by the proof gallon.
That's on us. That's on us then.
Yeah, that's smart.
So, you know, we also, when we look at just the area, and what has your distilling business kind of done for economic impact in the area too? Because as I mentioned earlier, like, it looks like you've kind of cornered the market on the distilling side. We were driving around, and this is the only one that kind of looks like you're doing the bourbon whiskey and gin and liqueur and everything else like that.
Yeah, I mean, I could answer that probably a couple different ways. One, for the local community, I think we've become somewhat of our own destination here in the Finger Lakes. So, you know, a lot of people that are here for the natural beauty of the area, or to, you know, enjoy the wineries, and they just happen upon us, or they, you know, we're part of their trip here. But we also get people that come that say that they're here specifically to see us. And so I think that's done some good things for the local economy. I was very active with the New York State Distillers Guild and getting that formed and off the ground. And, you know, we've done some economic impact studies about the industry as a whole in New York, and it's pretty incredible what it's done. First and foremost, I guess the, you know, the most of the distilleries are farm distilleries, which require us to use New York State agriculture and what we make. So we're helping farms quite a bit in terms of buying ingredients.
You said your corn guy's like 2 miles down the road or something.
Yep. He's just over the hill. Yeah.
What's his name?
It's Bauer Farms.
There we go.
Yep.
Shout out to Bauer Farms.
Yeah.
Got some good grains.
So another question is, you know, you talked about people that are coming here just to see you all. What's the furthest that you've met somebody that they've traveled to just come see Finger Lakes Distilling?
Oh boy. I mean, we've had people from Scotland here that we've worked with. Other than that, I mean, we do see people from all over the world.
I sent somebody from Dallas here last year.
Yeah, that's right. I remember.
Yeah. I was like, buddy's like, I'm going to be in the Finger Lakes region. I was like, well, you should go to Finger Lakes Distilling. Yeah. There you go. Here's Brian's number.
But you know, this is an ideal spot for like, if you live in a Northeast city, Philadelphia, New York City, even Boston, you know, it's a great like little weekend getaway.
Escape the busyness of the city.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a beautiful region. We enjoy the views and obviously enjoy the whiskey.
Yeah, the whiskey's, the views are nice, but the whiskey.
That's what brought us here.
That's what brought us here.
It makes us stay here.
You know, I mean, I think another thing you kind of look at is, you know, as somebody who is also forecasting, like, what are you predicting and looking and changing in regards of your all strategy to help, you know, push your distillery into what's going to be here in the next 3, 4, 5, 10 years?
Well, I think it's evaluating distributor relationships in a lot of ways, because if you've got the right people that really believe in your story and your product and everything, they're going to be very effective at trying to move some product for you. I spend a lot of time trying to tell our story and getting out to different markets and that kind of thing. But, you know, you can only go so far.
A one-person team is not, it's hard to scale.
You know, and we've had family that's helped with that. And Jared, you know, he's a good salesperson for us too. But yeah, it's really now trying to find those partners that can kind of push the product out into new markets and not just have it, you know, sit in a warehouse or on a shelf somewhere.
What current markets are you in now?
We're in 14 states right now. Northeast, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania. Our distributor there has moved into Kentucky now and Indiana.
That's right. I was at Westport Wine and Whiskey. I was like, hey, there's McKenzie.
Just opened up the Mid-Atlantic a little bit. And then we have some West Coast distribution too.
Very nice.
And just speaking of the name McKenzie too, you know, you came out with the McKenzie rye and all this other sort of stuff, but you know, you put your name on a bottle. Like when you did it, is it like, hey, we're just going to put my name on it? Or was that, did you have like, you're throwing a bunch of ideas around, and how did that name stick?
Well, our first distiller was also a McKenzie, but not related to me. So yeah, we kind of thought we had to go that direction.
I don't know, flip a coin.
Yeah. So that was kind of the story for a while, you know. Yeah, I'm proud of it. You know, I think it kind of pays respect to the Scottish roots and history of, there's a lot of McKenzie's in the whiskey business, I'll tell you that. I think there's three at Jack Daniel's. So yeah, I think it's a good name for the product.
And you don't really think you're somewhat not related to even anybody in the distilling industry? Do you have you?
Oh, I'm sure.
Have you?
Sure.
Yeah, called the you know, what's the online genealogy one?
23andMe or
something like that. Try to figure out like where do we all match up?
Jacob here? Call was saying how he did that. He got. Did his genealogy, and you know, like figured out I had more relatives in the distilling.
Yeah, so. And then they get the sample, and it's filled with whiskey.
Been exactly. So yeah,
it's okay. That's one way to do it. But Brian, I want to say thank you again for coming on the show today. And for inviting us up here as well. I mean, this is it's a pleasure to finally come do this in person, sip some great whiskey as well, and be able to see this little place you call home every day.
Yeah.
No, this is great having you guys here. It's been. Long time in the works, and it's just something I've been looking forward to. So great to have you.
Yeah. Well, next time we're gonna put a few more days, and we're gonna go on the.
I know. Go on the jet
ski. Yeah, the pontoon, the jet ski over here, and
get you guys out on the wakeboard if you want.
Oh man, dude, I'll tell you one story. So my roommate in college, he's you know had a boat, big lake wakeboarder in Lake Cumberland, and I remember the first time he's like, yeah, sure, get on, go and try it. get on, like I fall like on my face like 5 times in a row. He's like, all right, get back in the boat. You're done. I haven't tried it again since then.
I can wakeboard with you, Brian. Scared to get hurt, but I'll survive. I'll be all right.
Are you a good wakeboarder?
I'm not too bad. Yeah. Not too bad.
You're out there carving it up. You're doing some jumps, jumping wake to wake.
I used to be better, but no.
Do you do the surfing at all?
No, I haven't tried that. My daughter just got into that, but
yeah. Surfing's cool. I like that because it's a little slower, less, you can't really, you can move around, but less chance of injury. I like it.
No, just throw me on a tube. I'll do tubing any day.
Yeah, we'll throw them off the tube.
You just swing it real hard.
Heck yeah.
Swing it real hard. But Brian, thank you again for coming on the show today. If people want to follow you, how do they do it?
We have all the, you know, Instagram and Facebook, and you can sign up for our newsletter on our website, just fingerlakesdistilling.com.
Yeah, FLX Distilling, I think is what it is. On Instagram and stuff like that too. So make sure you follow them. Make sure you follow us, Bourbon Pursuit, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Really a little bit everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should be on TikTok.
Yeah, we're doing a little bit of everything now. But again, if you're listening to this, you're probably already subscribed. But if not, make sure you subscribe, tell your friends, join our newsletter. We got one of those too, bourbonpursuit.com. And with that, cheers, everybody. And we'll see you all next week.